Hey, this is episode number 50 of the Future Thinkers podcast. This is part two of our interview with Dan Jeffries, author, futurist, and thinker. Here we dive deeper into discussing ideologies, systems thinking, and the meaning of life. To listen to the first part of the interview, go to futurethinkers.org/49. And for all the show notes and resources mentioned in this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/50.
We attended several crypto conferences in Puerto Rico earlier in March, namely D10E and Coin Agenda. And we'll be doing a conference recap, which you can find at cryptoradio.io. Before we get into the show, we want to say thank you to our recent patrons, Julian, Chad, Jimmy, and Chris.
This episode is brought to you by Qualia, a premium nootropic supplement that helps support mental performance and brain health. It's specifically designed to promote focus, support energy, mental clarity, mood, memory, and creativity. Yuvi and I have both used it in the past. We really like it, and we actually met the founders and interviewed them on Future Thinkers. And you can check out those interviews. They're one of our favorites at futurethinkers.org/Daniel and futurethinkers.org/Jordan. They've got a new formula up called Qualia Mind. It's got more natural ingredients, and you can get it at futurethinkers.org/brainhack, and you can get 10% off if you use the code FUTURE.
All right, let's get into the show.
Welcome to futurethinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvi Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you'd like a list of our top episodes and resources, go to futurethinkers.org/start.
And if you like our podcast, leave us a rating and a review on iTunes and elsewhere. It really helps others find the show, and we really appreciate it.
So I'm beginning to move on to additional concepts. One of the ones that I'm about to write on now and I'm starting to think about is the use of killer robots. There was just a video, for instance, that came out about using the dronies, which are the tiny little helicoptery things, as like pinpoint precision guided missiles with facial recognition.
Oh, yeah. Yes. We saw that the other day. That was freaky.
It's one of the most terrifying things I've ever seen. It's given me nightmares. And it's given me nightmares because it's really, really close and possible. In fact, I talked to one of the top AI guys in the world recently about this. I was like, oh, you know, it's so close. Once you build these sort of system on a chip kind of things that they're working on for deep learning and all this type of stuff, it's just around the corner. It's like, oh, you don't even need that. It's wireless, right? So you could, as long as there's a connection to it, you could have all the intelligence in a centralized data center. Yeah. And that scared me worse, right?
Yeah.
I have not been an alarmist on artificial intelligence, for instance. I think that artificial intelligence will bring many wonderful benefits as well as many ones that are not good. And we tend to focus on big, stupid problems like superintelligence, and I'm like, we might not even get there.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about superintelligence taking over the universe and turning us all into paperclips. Like, why are we worrying about this, right? We can't solve that problem right now, right? And B, we can't solve that problem right now. Okay, totally ridiculous to think about. However, the idea that I could have these little explosive dronies or darts, like specifically target people, is something I don't have a solution to. And it scares me they don't have a solution to it. Mm-hmm. The only two things I've been able to come up with is a universal ban, which I am 100% convinced will not be followed.
No, because you can 3D print these parts, and then, you know, all you need is some basic programming understanding, and then to find existing templates out there, like, you could actually do this quite easily. There's this really cool YouTube video I saw recently that was like a sort of a drama. It was a fiction that demonstrated these drones that you're talking about. It was super freaky. It showed an assassination of a group of like students. Basically, they let these like swarm of drones go in and kill everyone in this room. And it was within seconds because they could each just move so quickly to the person's head and then explode or shoot a single bullet. Just so easy to assassinate people with that. And then I was thinking, like, how can you stop that? What's the physical mechanism to stop that? Other drones that kind of swarm around and like kamikaze themselves? Or EMPs, or, you know, there's just no practical solution to stopping this. Banning's not going to work either.
The guys behind it, there's actually a mission, a number of sort of actual artificial intelligence professors and things who are like, we need to get like an international ban like now. And I'm actually in support of an international ban. This is one of the few things I really agree with the kind of alarmists on. And yet I just don't think that it's going to be, like you said, the average person will be able to 3D print this and write some Python and some C and make it a reality. The other part is I have every belief system that black budgets and centralized governments will just continue to do it in the dark.
Of course.
You know, like there's zero chance it doesn't happen. And it's game theory, right? It's like, well, if the bad guys are going to do it, we got to do it too. And so then it comes back to, right, like what you're talking about. Do I build like countermeasures for the thing? these are the things where I'm like, okay, if I don't have a ready-made answer, these are the types of things I will come up with an answer. And to do that, I will have to spend many, 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 many frustrating months considering it, but I will develop a potential mitigation system for it. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it looks like, but I'm going to spend some time thinking about it. I'm going to spend some time writing about it to raise awareness of it, because I think that in some ways, actually, the way to define mitigations is to take yourself out of it as an individual, take yourself out of the fear and look at it from an objective standpoint. So you have to be able to say, like, what are the benefits of a system and what are the bad things of a system? You go, wait, the benefits of that? Like, what would be the benefits? Well, the benefits are, in many ways, if these systems did exist, okay, and please don't take this as my sort of personal yes to this, okay, I don't want these things to happen, but the personal benefit of these types of things, if you take your ego out of it and your fear out of it, is there's a lot less collateral damage in a war, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm dropping a bomb on a village and blowing up a house, I might take out a lot of different people, plus I've destroyed the infrastructure, all kinds of problems, right?
You take out the cruise missile and you replace it with a single drone that's targeting one person, it makes a lot more sense.
Right. So from a warfighting standpoint, actually it's in many ways beneficial to have something like that, which is even more terrifying to think of, that there's actually a good use case for it. And so at the same time, in order to design a system, you have to be able to look at it objectively in order to understand the pluses and minuses, and that's how you can divine mitigations to it. I always say that when you design a system, you also have to be able to design all the ways to destroy that system or hack that system in order to be able to protect it. And so for me, as I begin to think about this problem, I begin to think about all the reasons that a country or an individual would want to utilize these things. What would be the benefits to them? And I have to think through all of those things in order to be able to divine effective countermeasures to it. If you can't address the motivation for using the thing, and you can't acknowledge the usefulness of it for that motivation, then you can't design an effective mitigation system for it.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's really funny because it's so counter to what we hear about in like millennial left wing way of thinking, where it's like, we don't talk about that. We don't think about that. That's takes me out of my safe space. Yeah, I like that you kind of dive into the exact reason not to do it and saturate yourself with that idea to try and come up with solutions for it.
Not thinking about things in life is not effective at all. I mean, we have to be able to think about the darkness as well as the light. You have to think about the good and the bad. You know, when I went to college, there were no safe spaces and you were exposed to all kinds of things that you might not agree with and good, you know, really good. Honestly, I do not talk about my political stances on things, but I consider myself, when people try to pinpoint my ideology, I am what I call an atomicist. I made up the word. Okay. An atomicist, meaning I look at each individual issue on its own merits and make a decision. And thus my views run the gamut from left to right and everything between. Right. And if I get new information that changes my mind, I will change my mind again. And this is also something we seem to prize now, like the rigid adherence to this stance, right? Like that's a fucking good thing, right? Like I've got new information that tells me I'm completely fucking stupid and wrong. And I'm going to hold to that ideology as if there's like, how ridiculous is that we prize that in society, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But the reason I said all that is because for me, college is about being uncomfortable. It's about being exposed to things you don't like, right? And it's fine to say like, hey, there's a trigger warning in here. Fine. I guess it's nice to know that there might be like something horrifying in this paper, right? But so what? Whether it's there or not doesn't mean shit to me. You're supposed to be exposed to shit that you don't like or don't understand or don't want to know about. That is how you freaking grow in life. More and more in life, we're building these echo chambers. That's the left's equivalent of like just going and listening to one type of news ideology on the right. You see what I mean? I have my safe space. It's the flip side of the coin for I'm only going to listen to this one podcast and read these five forums on Facebook, and everything else is biased and everything else is a conspiracy right against me, right? It's like those two ideologies are creating people who are just living in an echo chamber and never learning anything. My greatest teacher and mentor told me that education is what you are exposed to. In other words, like the things that you're exposed to, some of which make you uncomfortable, some of which are things you don't want to think about or hear, is how you grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We interviewed Jordan Peterson on our podcast earlier this year, and a lot of our listeners were quite unhappy with that because they thought that we shouldn't even be giving a platform to his ideas. They were so offended by us having on the podcast. Some of them actually stopped being Patreon subscribers.
If Hitler was still alive, I would interview him on our podcast. Fuck those people who think that way. Seriously. So stupid. Don't give him a platform.
No, I agree. Like, in other words, absolutely give the people who have pernicious ideologies or whatever a platform. Let's expose them to the light.
Yes.
You just let them be in the dark or whatever. You don't ask them a tough question that makes them uncomfortable. You don't challenge them, right? And nobody challenges them. It's backwards, right? It's just, it's totally backwards, right? Absolutely, you give the people the platform and you challenge them. You challenge their logic. You challenge their thinking about it. You don't let them squirm out of it.
Or you learn from it. You get something new. If your ideas are so different and you hear something completely different, then you're just going to improve as a person. And that's the perspective I took with Jordan. I actually had dived into his content a lot and really had changed a lot of my perspectives and wanted to have him on the show to, you know, dive in even further. So like that was a success case, I think, for me to grow as a person, to have someone completely different on.
Yeah, or just dismissing somebody because you disagree with some of their ideas, dismissing all of their ideas as wrong or bad is completely absurd. Like, I actually disagree maybe with 10 or 20% of his ideas, but most of his ideas I completely agree with. I think he's a brilliant psychologist. He speaks out a lot of against this kind of social justice warrior, a safe space, overprotected people who can't observe how biology works or who can't observe how hierarchies work and why hierarchies would be useful for people because we're mammals. And they just couldn't accept these ideas at all. And they would reject everything else he says because of this. Ridiculous.
I don't know his work or I don't really know who that is, but it doesn't matter, right? I understand exactly what you're talking about. Like, people have this ideological purity test now where it's like, okay, do you match these 12 things? If not, everything you say is wrong. And that is throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It's insane. Again, I'm an atomicist. Each statement and position that somebody takes, I'm listening to that individually on its own merits. And we actually don't understand this anymore in the world. Like, one of the shittiest arguments now is you are biased. Everyone is fucking biased, idiots. Pay attention. You cannot not be biased because you are a limited creature in an unlimited universe, okay? You cannot possibly have all of the information. It is literally 100% impossible to have a perfect perspective as a individual existing within the universe, okay? So you are limited, therefore you are biased because you do not understand everything. You are not omnipotent. Okay. And they also don't understand that bias now means wrong, also incorrect, also a stupid logical fallacy. Okay. I might completely be biased about many things, but when I say a factual statement like the sun rises in the morning, it is still a factual statement. Okay. And the fact that I am biased about other things means absolutely nothing to that factual statement. It is a dangerous place for the world when people begin to take these positions en masse in society.
Yeah.
When people begin to say there's nothing valuable on the other side, other people have nothing to say to me, other people have nothing to teach me, I am right on everything, is a fucking disease. It is a mental disease, and it always leads to the same thing, mass violence. It leads to war. That's what it leads to. Because if you cannot function in society with other people, we have a different perspective, and you say everyone must agree with me, that is either fascism or communism. They're flip sides of the same coin.
Yes.
Right? Like, one is an extreme of the left and one is an extreme of the right. There's even people say, no, you know, both are extremes of the right or extreme of the left. Sorry, guys, you're fucking wrong. One is an extreme of the left and one is an extreme of the right. They're both the same ideology. Communism and fascism are essentially the exact same ideology, and both of them believe that you impose a rigid order upon what everyone thinks, and everyone must follow it. And anyone who doesn't must be destroyed. We're edging towards that level of stupidity in society. I'm right about everything. No, other side doesn't know shit. Sorry, but you're wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Kind of wanted to switch gears, but on a related topic. We talked, I guess, last week or 2 weeks ago, quite extensively about sort of meditation, enlightenment, and consciousness. And it was really interesting conversation. But the reason actually we got into this and heard about you is because of the Rick and Morty article that you wrote. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit about that article for people who haven't listened to it, and then we can kind of go off on another tangent from that.
The Rick and Morty article, I really use Rick and Morty because I love the show as kind of an angle to talk about what I think is a central theme of the show, and that is that at its core, life is meaningless. And when you really boil down everything, when you just follow the rabbit hole all the way down, life is meaningless. But I believe the challenge in Rick and Morty is you have two choices from that. One is you crumple in a pit of despair and do nothing. And the other is you strike out, right? Have an adventure, embrace life, make your own meaning, right? That meaning is contextual. And so eventually what you get to, if you successfully pass through the eye of the needle, is that life has meaning directly to you. So it does have meaning. It both doesn't and does, right? It's this quantum paradox, right, where it's utterly meaningless. And by the system being agnostic in terms of being meaningless, meaning is quantum, okay, in that the skyscraper does not have any meaning in and of itself. The ant does not have any meaning in and of itself. But when the ant decides that it's going to climb the skyscraper, it has created that meaning through context. And now both the ant has a reason to exist and the skyscraper. The skyscraper is there for the ant to climb it, and the ant needs something to climb for its will power to attach to. And so it has meaning as well, right? And so every moment is the meaning of life. Every interaction is meaning of life. Every place is the center of the universe. I was seeing that in the episodes as I was watching it. I was feeling that, something that I'd experienced in my own life, that realization. And then when I saw the little documentary from the creator that was like 4 minutes at the end where he explicitly called it out, I knew it wasn't a mirage that I was just seeing. And so I decided it would be fun to kind of write the story and bring in some of the stuff that had sort of brought me to similar conclusions.
How did you get started on that path? What was your call to adventure to go and explore the rabbit hole?
It started at a very, very young age for me, where I went through a lot of kind of the typical trappings of studying consciousness and spirituality and the nature of reality from a very young age. I had promised myself that I would see life as it actually is instead of how I imagined it to be, which is sort of a ridiculous promise for like a six-year-old to make to himself. And so I spent a lot of time looking at different spiritual modalities and all these things. And there was just this nagging uncertainty. There was this nagging feeling underneath it all that this shit doesn't work. You know, whatever it is, like, you know, meditation or going to the ashram or yoga or getting high, whatever the hell you want to, none of it really works. Like that it works for a period of time or it's really useful. Like merging with the God consciousness and all this shit, right, is really a cool experience, but it's not enlightenment. It's not true understanding. And so I just kind of kept looking. And I came across these books through a friend of mine who had always given me very interesting books from this guy named Jeb McKenna. And I read through all of his stuff, and it was really like just an absolute, likely terrifying experience, and sort of sent me through the rabbit hole, if you will. It would often felt sort of physically ill reading his books, or like I was falling out of a plane with no parachute, right? And so really the books are an absolute demolition of many belief systems and exhortation to get to like, well, what is true? And I kind of came to a similar conclusion through my own work to his, and that is that like enlightenment as we conceive it is really just something out of a sales pitch. Which is like, A, you're going to have this beatific smile on your face and you're always going to be happy. Like, it's a state of mind that's so crazy ass awesome that like anyone would be an idiot not to want it. And that's why it's not real. So what the hell is enlightenment? Truth realization is the best definition I currently have for it. And that is that when you stop believing in illusions and you stop believing in even the last illusions, which are like all of the gurus that exist out there, right? Like they're what I call and McKenna calls the last unwitting agents of Maya, right? In other words, they're not even aware that they're holding people back at the threshold, and that people imagine that if you just sit there and listen to the almighty guru, that somehow you'll be enlightened as well. And yet they have a 0% success rate. There's nobody who's ever come out of any of these schools of thought and said, I am enlightened because I sat there listening to so-and-so for 10 years. Nobody has ever said that. And therefore, the reality stares you in the face. And you have to say, what can I say about a school that has a 0% success rate? Is that a successful school? The answer is no. And so what does that tell me about it, right? If I went to like programming school and they told me there was a 0% success rate, I'd say that's a horrible school. If they said there was a 50% success rate, that's a horrible school. And so realizing that these things are kind of an illusion, it's a real relief. I don't have to worry about any of this shit again. I don't have to go to an ashram. I don't have to travel the world. I can travel the world if I want to. I can create meaning for myself through the things that I love and that I care about. And the meaning is contextual. The meaning of life is not what is the meaning of life. That's the wrong question. That's a universal question that has no answer. The correct question is, what does it mean to you? What is the meaning of life to you? And when you stop trying to keep all the plates spinning in life, when you stop trying to do everything else that people tell you to do, when you stop chasing these fantasies of there's something in the afterlife, or there's another life after this one where I'm reincarnated, or there's this beatific state that I can achieve, or like I'm super happy all the time. And when you stop worrying about that, then you can just live your life and you can really find the true joy in life. Spending time with your family and loved ones, eating things that you like or make you feel healthy, and sometimes eating something that's unhealthy and enjoying that too. You know, exercising, creating things, writing, recording, painting, traveling, you know, spending time with, you know, with your animals, whatever these things are, right? You stop worrying about all these other things, it opens up all the possibility for the true meaning of life, which is spending time on the things that you love.
There was something you said a few weeks ago when we talked, and then again today, about not doing what you feel like the universe, or I don't know if that's specifically what you said, but what the universe is trying to stop you to do, doing instead what just is in flow, is what you're meant to be doing. And you had said that, you know, trying to make this cicada thing, everything was going wrong, it wasn't working. And then you said, when I started focusing on writing, things started to fall in place. And I really like the way you described that before, because it's been very similar to us as well. Like when we've tried to do various different businesses or tried different projects and stuff, things don't work, and you can kind of get a sense for why they're not working or how they're not working.
It feels like grinding.
Yeah, exactly. But there's a certain switch where you feel like there's something else that you're doing that you know you're meant to be doing, and everything just falls away completely easily. Like all the obstacles are almost fun to play with, or like obstacles you would build into a really fun game rather than something that's just a grind.
Well, it is. Like, it's still hard work. But at the same time, I find, for instance, when I sit down to write, that there's this period where my mind's going crazy and I'm worrying about things and it's getting in the way and it's kind of, I'm pecking around at the page and I'm not quite getting it down and can't quite make the sentence work. And then all of a sudden, I pass through this portal and I'm not there anymore and my fingers are just going and like all of my problems fall away. I'm immune to death and disease and to anything happening to me at that moment in time, and I'm just flowing. I'm not there. And then I kind of like wake up at the end of it. I have no idea what happened, right? It's just, and it's all just kind of poured out of me. And it's one of the things that I live for. There are these signposts. It's almost like Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, right? Where it's like there are these weird coincidences or synchronicities, right, that happen. And those are actually not coincidences at all. Those are actually the guideposts for life. And when things are going well, or when you're doing the things that you were meant to do, the synchronicities pop up constantly. Like every time I run into a wall in terms of writing a piece of fiction where I don't know what to do next with a particular character, or I don't have a piece of information, I'll suddenly have an idea the next day when I wake up for one of the 3,000 books on my shelf that I haven't looked at in 5 years to go pick that book up. And I'll flip open the pages and there'll be the information that I need. And I've just learned to trust that thing, right? It is something that, like, when I read the Dirk Gentlys as a kid, I didn't understand it at all. I read them right after reading The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And I love those books as a kid because they're really consumable as a young person. And then I immediately switched to Dirk Gently. I'm like, I hate these books. What the hell is this crap? But as an older person now, seeing that weird synchronicity, like bumbling around in the dark kind of guide where you don't have full control and you're just sort of trusting the universe to put out the lights at the exact moment in time that you need them, is something that I think you learn later in life.
So in your opinion, having studied this and kind of gone into a very practical experience of it recently, what do you think is the mechanism that is allowing this to happen? Like, can you relate it to any kind of spiritual doctrine or practice? How does it happen and why does it happen?
So that's where you get into trouble. That's how you start creating a new ideology, you start creating a new spiritual practice or whatever. And it's just us projecting our tiny mind. The goal is not to understand why. You can speculate on it for fun. It's just the problem is you can't actually come to a definitive conclusion. You can pretend you came to a definitive conclusion and write it down and create an ideology to conscript people and get them to follow you. But in actuality, nobody can ever get to the actual reason behind the mechanism. All you can do is say, look, the tide rolls in and the tide rolls out. I can effectively observe that. Why the tide rolls in and rolls out is where you get into trouble. You cannot come to a correct conclusion. You can come to a conclusion that you believe to be the correct conclusion, but in fact, you cannot come to the conclusion.
I think if I remember correctly, we said it's something to do with, or it could actually quite literally be related to the particle wave phenomenon, where you cannot make it happen when you're looking directly at it. And therefore, you cannot measure it and you cannot figure out how it works.
Or you can see that the instantiation of it in that moment, but that's all you can see. You can never see the whole thing in its entirety.
Yeah.
Correct, right? And you can speculate on the mechanisms behind it. Is it fine determinism? Is it math? Is it the prime mover? Is it pantheism? Is it a specific creature? Is it the muse? Whatever. The point is, doesn't really matter. It's fun to think about some of those things, but it is a distraction. And it's something where it's better to just observe the mechanism and stop worrying about the speculation of it and then live within the rule sets that it creates. And life becomes a lot easier. You know, you like to pet your dog or you like to pet your cat and your cat likes to snuggle with you or your dog likes to snuggle with you. You don't need to know why that is. In other words, it's just, you know that you and the animal both enjoy those things. The animal's wired that way and you're wired that way. The universe is wired that way for that mechanism to be an expression of joy and love. And so just express the joy and love and don't worry about why the system is designed that way, because it just makes you unhappy. And it makes you unhappy because it is unknowable. That's the problem, is trying to struggle with the ideas that are unknowable. You create the delusion for yourself that they are knowable. And when you create delusion, you create unhappiness.
This reminds me actually of something we talked about earlier, where you talked about in the decentralized autonomous organizations where people try to be everything at all times, it just doesn't work. It's chaos and everything falls apart. But when you have people in roles, it actually works. And people don't like that idea or whatever. They want to do everything themselves or have a say in everything. But it's a parallel, you know, like the meta narrative here is the same, that when you try to be everything or understand everything, it just doesn't work. It's chaos. You know, you came to this life with a specific purpose, or you're wired a specific way, or however you want to explain that, you're just predisposed to like certain things. You don't have to do everything. Just do those things.
I feel that DAOs, for instance, in the future, not to derail this, but to, you know, they will actually develop complex systems of rules and governing to allow people to exist in a role happily and know that there is actually a transparent mechanism to move forward within the organization, gather experience, gather understanding, and move on to a different role, shedding the old role. That's a natural evolution. And for a DAO to grow to the size of a Fortune 500 company, those mechanisms are going to have to replace a hierarchical rule system that's been very effective, whether we like it or not. It's been very effective in getting society to the point that it's at.
I asked you that question earlier about expiring currencies, and you just reminded me now of a conversation we had with Vince Means in one of our episodes about blockchain. And he said it would be interesting to have corporations and organizations and DAOs that dismantle after their objective has been accomplished. And we just don't see that in corporations now. Like, it's all about optimizing and increasing revenue. There's no such thing as a self-destructing company. And, you know, along the same lines, I'm just interested in this, and I'm interested in what a self-destructing currency looks like and how these things could be utilized with the technologies that we have now.
I don't know. I haven't thought much about the self-destructing currency. To me, that just seems to be a way to create sort of a scarcity, and so it might be useful from that standpoint. But I have thought about organizations that can self-compete within the organization. And so one of the things you see in a hierarchical organization is they come up with a specific idea that makes them very successful and wealthy, and they continue to build up the apparatus around it. But as the company grows from smaller groups of people to a larger group of people, the bureaucracy and the rule sets begin to strangle the innovation. And so even as the product begins to go downhill, competitors are not allowed within the system, and so they develop outside of the company. And you see something like that with, say, like a Kodak who went wrong, right, where they had every opportunity to dominate in the digital sphere. They ignored it because the system was geared to only incentivize people to focus on chemical film. And so potentially, and I have not quite figured out this mechanism yet, I would see DAOs as a series of tiny pods that almost act like independent companies and that can compete internally to evolve the system. And so that is, for instance, if you had an operating system that was sort of the dominant group, like say a Microsoft, and it had reached its peak, you might be able to spawn additional pods in there with different iterations and concepts to directly compete with the operating system and potentially knock it off to destroy it and create a replacement or an alternative business model. If you can get this mechanism down, it would absolutely be more effective than a corporation. If you get the governance and you get this internal competition correct, where the funding naturally flows to competition and to smaller groups that get to iterate and try things to potentially even knock off the king product and replace the business model, that is how you build like incredibly flexible, dynamic organizations. Haven't quite figured out the mechanisms for it, but I can easily see an organization like that eventually outperforming the rigidly hierarchical systems that we have today.
I mean, there's analogies for that in nature. Like it's like cell mutation and growth and cell death. Like you don't want all of the obsolete cells to continue dividing and dominating the system. You want the mutated and adapted version to keep going.
It was a question posed to a biologist, why do people die? And the answer was that for genes to mutate and for evolution to happen, because if people lived forever, then there would be no evolution. If you can't mutate the gene and you mutate the gene through forced senescence, so people have to reproduce, it could be the same with companies.
Was he saying it's sort of a preservation mechanism so that some catastrophic event in the future wouldn't wipe out the entire species all at once?
Yes, and so that they could adapt over time because right. The environment is changing.
Right.
The environment is not static. And so it's basically, it doesn't care about the individual, it only cares about the gene pool.
Right. We talked a bit about that in an earlier thing, in that I always say God, and I hate to use this term because it immediately brings your own association, but God's morality is not our morality. I said this in the Rick and Morty article as well. And so whether it's God is the universe or God's an external thing or whatever, I tend to be sort of pantheistic. God, now I've sort of labeled myself here, but let's say I'm semi-pantheistic, right, where I think that the universe is God, the system is God, right? It's a vast, active, living, intelligent system, right? And that system in and of itself has its own morality that is different than ours, right? And from the standpoint of the individual creatures within the system, there are things that are bad for the individual, whereas the system itself, it may be a good thing. So certainly death for the individual, not awesome, not something we want, but beneficial in the way that you describe it. Just as if there is a dam that is holding back a river so that the river can't flow, and there are a bunch of farms beneath it, and the dam breaks, from the standpoint of all of the farmers that drowned, it really, really sucks. You don't want to be that. From the system standpoint, the river now flows effectively and has gone back to equilibrium, and therefore, from a system standpoint, it is effective, right? And so that's sort of similar to what they're saying, in that the system evolves through death and mutation, and that is beneficial to the system, even if it sucks for the individual dying.
Yeah, it's interesting actually to think of this, how do we structure our organizations to mimic nature, because nature has had a really long time to figure things out. I don't want to say nature knows better, because it implies that nature has consciousness, and it might or it might not, but in any case, it's just had a really long time to figure things out. And, you know, we from our tiny perspectives have our own ideas about how to structure things. Sometimes we really mess it up and we don't take into consideration this bigger perspective. We had Daniel Schmachtenberger on the show a couple episodes ago, and he was talking about this kind of competitive nature. When it gets to the global scale, it ends up in really existentially bad scenarios, because when there's a finite playing field, which is the Earth's resources, and you try to play this infinite competitive game, you end up just leveling the playing field. You end up destroying everything. So he talks about how we have to take this holistic perspective, and where we can't be competing with each other. Corporations can't be competing with each other endlessly, because we're just going to destroy everything.
I know Daniel actually pretty well, and I'm in the think tank that I referred to earlier is... he's in that think tank.
Oh, what?
Oh, cool.
I was just going to say, you got to meet Daniel. He's in a think tank as well. And I think you guys would really agree with each other in a lot of points. That's funny.
We do. I mean, we diverge on a few things, but at the same point, that think tank exists because there's a bunch of smart people, all of which who have different perspectives. And again, we all recognize that the universal truth that none of us has a complete understanding of everything. And so better for us to kind of come together and think about the future. And that group in particular is very concerned about precisely what you said, and that is that, you know, our weapons are too big for the battlefield, if you will. And if a society kind of goes down this time, it might be a complete reset of the Earth, right? From the Earth's perspective, it doesn't matter if we all die off. From our perspective, it's not so awesome. I always say, for instance, that the Earth isn't in trouble. We are. So we can continue to completely shit it up as much as we want, and the Earth will just delete us at some point, sleep for a million years, rebuild itself, and evolve a more empathic and intelligent species the next time around. And it won't give a shit. That'll be precisely fine from its perspective. So the only thing that we need to worry about is changing so that we potentially continue to survive. And by the way, we've reached a point in our evolution where we potentially can wipe ourselves out 100 million times, and we haven't been around that long. Considering other species that have dominated this planet, like the trilobites for, you know, what, 160 million years? I think we've got 8 or 10 mil. We've got a long way to go, but we've already got the ability to completely annihilate ourselves. There's a book called A Collapse of Complex Societies, and it talks about the history of those societies. All of those societies, and Daniel talks about this, had a blast radius around them. Even like the Roman Empire, there was a blast radius. So when it went down, it was confined within that area. It sucked to be in that area. It sucked to be living through that time. But it wasn't the whole world. Now society is global, and our weapons have the ability to smash the world like a tiny egg, and that's terrifying. And then there's another book that we talk about there, and it's called Finite and Infinite Games. And it's really, anybody designing blockchain systems should absolutely read that book, because their finite games are things where you can kind of define the rules and who a winner is. But life is not a finite game. It has a series of finite games in it. But it is an infinite game. The rules are changing constantly. And how you win, quote unquote, is there's no final winner. And how you win even a specific transaction is like sand under your feet. It's constantly moving.
I've heard this book, Finite and Infinite Games, mentioned many times now. I think I got to dive into that.
Yeah.
I think you'll like it. I mean, it's pretty good. It's dense reading. It's not exactly a like pick it up and read it at the beach kind of thing. But it's very useful if you're thinking about systems design.
Dan, anything else you want to talk about before we finish up here?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we covered a huge amount of ground, from the nature of consciousness to universal blockchain systems to economics. So it was pretty awesome. I had a lot of fun, guys. I appreciate it.
Cool. Yeah, us too. This is very interesting for us.
Now, let's try to tie it all together. I mean...
Yeah, right. All right. Now give us a one-sentence tie-in, okay?
The pressure is on.
Bringing it all together, I would say, if you're still trying to figure out what your purpose in life is to figure out your purpose in life, and to figure out what your work is and do that work. And when you read some of these New Age things and it sounds too good to be true, it probably is, and ask yourself, when somebody claims to have achieved this sort of infinity consciousness or this beatific consciousness, ask yourself, what is the realistic mechanism to get there? And if they say that the answer is sort of meditation or whatever, ask yourself if you've ever come across any human being in the entire planet ever who has achieved that consciousness through meditation. Have you ever met that person? Have you ever seen that person? I think what you end up finding is that when people write about these things, it sounds really good, but they can't actually define what the mechanism is. And so stop worrying about the mechanism. Just figure out what it is that you care about in life. Figure out your own personal meaning and do that thing with great joy. And you won't have to worry about anything. The money will find you. The right relationships will find you. Your place in the universe will find you. It's a call to adventure. The hero with a thousand faces story, it's your story. It's not somebody you're reading about. It's not some other hero. You're the hero of your own life and you're called to adventure. And the answer is to just accept it and stop worrying about trying to achieve a fictitious level of consciousness. Find the things that you care about and do those.
Yep, totally agree. Dan, thanks for joining us. This has been a lot of fun.
Awesome, yeah.
Thank you so much, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. This was the second part of our interview with Dan Jeffries. You can find all the show notes and links at futurethinkers.org/50. And to hear the first part of this interview, go to futurethinkers.org/49. We'll see you in the next episode. Bye!